This is Talk of the Nation. Neil Conan is away. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington. Let me tell you a story. In the Holy Land, a box of ancient bones is discovered, but not just any bones. An inscription on the box says, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. Could this be material proof of the existence of Jesus? Well, it was certainly a news story that ran on all kinds of media outlets, including NPR.
News now of what may be the oldest reference to Jesus ever found by archaeologists. It is a limestone box with an inscription on it in Aramaic.
That was All Things Considered back in 2002. Now, there's a reason I said I wanted to tell you a story, as in a tall tale, as in a fabrication.
It was heralded as potentially the oldest reference to Jesus ever found by archaeologists, but now the Israeli Antiquities Authority has ruled it was a fake.
The story of how an ancient box of bones known as an ossuary went from sensational find to unsavory fraud is the subject of a new book by journalist Nina Burley. She joins us in a moment. But later, New Yorker editor David Remnick joins us to tell us why he wrote a 15-page piece about Barack Obama and race in the most recent issue. But first, faith, fraud, science, and politics. What role do religious artifacts play in your faith? Does it matter if you found out later they were not what they claimed to be? Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. You can also email us. The address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Nina Burley joins us from our bureau in New York. Her book is called Unholy Business, A True Tale of Faith, Greed, and Forgery in the Holy Land. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Nina.
Thank you.
So you've called this story The Maltese Falcon Meets Raiders of the Lost Ark with a little bit of the Da Vinci Code thrown in. How did this story begin for you?
Well, I was sitting in my house in upstate New York trying to channel the Sahara Desert, working on a book that I finished before this on archaeologists working in Egypt. And to procrastinate, I picked up the New York Times around Christmas time of 04 and read the article that you mentioned, five men indicted for a scheme to forge high-end, very well-known, famous biblical archaeology. And I hadn't heard of the James Ossuary. So I read this and I thought, first of all, I'm not a very religious person, but the older I've gotten, the more sort of fascinated I am by people of faith and respectfully fascinated. And I read this and I thought, well, first of all, people of faith, do they need proof? Do they need material objects for this, for their faith? And secondly, what manner of men would deviously create it for them? So that's how I got into it. I read the article. It was Christmas time 04, and I kind of put it on the back burner. I was finishing the other book, working on other things, and you know, periodically checked in with it. And then finally in 06, in the fall of 06, I got on an airplane and flew over to Tel Aviv, and never had been into Israel before. I'd been in and out of the Middle East a lot as a journalist, Baghdad, Jordan, places like that, but I'd never gone into Israel. Got off the plane, and of course, because the passport is stamped all over with Arab countries, I was taken aside and interviewed for that, very politely and pleasantly. And but actually, from that moment forward, I felt like I had stepped into a Scheherazade tale or a movie. I met some of the most eccentric characters and explored one of the most one of the strangest subcultures I've ever been exposed to, which is people who get ancient history out of the ground, often illegally, and buy and sell it legally in Israel to a group of people who collect biblical archaeology for their homes. And some ended up in museums, some ended up at Sotheby's, but a lot of it is going to a small group of people who just have a taste for this ancient stuff.
You mentioned that there's been an increase in desire for these artifacts. Why is that?
Well, I think over the last maybe 20 years, there's been more access to these digs. I mean, Israel, there are 30,000 archaeological sites in the Holy Land, and there's more access to them now after the 67 war. But also, I think, you know, there's a lot of religious, there's an upswing in religious fundamentalism, right, in all three religions, and certainly here in the United States. And this material is in great demand among people of sort of the newer persuasions, the more fundamentalist believers, I guess. And so there's that. And then simply the access, I think. There's more digging going on, more illegal digging going on.
Well, in the case of the James Ossuary, I'm sort of curious. Initially, when it appeared, you write a bit about this, people were quick to say, oh, yes, this could be something, but it's somewhat of a, if someone writes a paper about it and then someone else reads the paper and says, yeah, that could be the case, that could be true. Can you explain to me why so many people were able to say, yes, I believe this is authentic, and be so wrong?
Well, I can't speak for the scientists, and let's just state right up front here before we get any further that the owner of the ossuary, who is on trial for forging it, maintains his innocence and contends that it's not fake, and that there are still people out there, even in the face of all the scientific evidence, who are saying that it's not a fake.
You make a pretty good case in your book for us to believe it's probably
not
real.
I don't buy that these scientists who investigated it with chemical and chemical means analyses and microscopes who looked at it closely and found modern materials, buried in these ancient letters. I don't buy that they had a vendetta or some kind of reason to do this other than they were asked to do it and investigate it. So that's kind of why it looks like I agree with them. However, there is this other side. And to answer your first question, people come to these objects, and this is part of what's so fascinating about this world. People come to these objects, even if they're scientists, with belief systems, and they're looking at them through the lens of belief systems. So biblical archaeology is a point where it's sort of the limit where science kind of operates on the borders of belief and belief in an otherworldly beings. So it's a very interesting and strange kind of subculture. And the scientists, there are scientists who are in the middle ground with this. They'll take the Bible and they'll say, the Bible is a historical document. It is accurate as to the geography of this area, and then there are people on either end of the spectrum. On one end, who say the Bible is completely accurate in every way, and that every single thing that's mentioned in it will, if we look far enough, we will find some kind of object that relates to it if we're lucky. And then on the very other side, they're what are called the minimalists. And there are people who think the Bible is utter fiction and should not be held up when people are over there digging as any sort of a guide. So there's this war going on in biblical archaeology all the time between these two forces. And it's really, really gotten more and more pitched because there are also issues of Israeli nationalism involved here.
Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. I do want to bring in one of our listeners who really gets to one of the points you make in the book. He I believe it's a he, gets to it quite well. Let's talk to Muzz in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Muzz.
Hi, how are you?
It is a he. Hi, Muzz. In this discussion of artifacts and faith, what did it lead you to believe or to conclude?
I love the topic of faith because it's the principle of believing without having the fact, and that is faith. And, if you're going to entertain the idea that life is a test and we're all here to do what we're supposed to do, then believing in God and having that faith is the point of it, and that's what it's all about. It's not like a news report, like, this just in, Jesus did live, Jesus existed, this just in, Muslims are right, this just in. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't, it's what it is to the person, and it's more so like, believing in what you don't know is true. It would be great if the prophecy was fulfilled, and then it was, that's great. It's not like I don't want to see, Jesus return. I would love to see it happen just like it was written. That's the faith. But to find an artifact and, you know, a bone or whatever they're going to dig up next. I think that's not the point of it. I think there's a bigger picture.
All right, Muzz from Phoenix, thanks for weighing in.
All right, thank you.
Nina, do you find the people who were involved in these digs, are they thrill seekers? Are they people out there who just want to make some money, or are they true believers?
Well, in the sanctioned sites where the archaeologists are actually digging, every summer, I did run across people from theological institutions in the United States and in other countries who are working there. And so, yes, there is that aspect to it. All of these sites, all of these digs cost money. And the streams of money come from often people with an interest. Not always. I mean, sometimes it's just strictly academic, but often they get help from, theological organizations or in the case of ancient, Judaica, they have funding coming from some Israeli nationalist organizations who are looking for proof of ancient habitation. So there is there's theology and politics in the funding stream, but also the digging. We haven't gotten into this, but there are the archaeologists digging at the sites. Then after dark, there are plunderers going in and with metal detectors, and the scholar cop who you had me reference early in the beginning, mm-hmm. His job, and he's, he and his 12 guys with 30,000 sites, you can imagine what kind of a job they've got.
That's
a workload. They could go out every night and find people with metal detectors going over these sites looking for stuff. The tombs there, the pre-biblical tombs contain, every person buried would have like 100 objects, personal objects with them. So there would be, there's bronze that's worth money for people.
It's obviously a treasure trove for someone mm-hmm. who is looking for sex.
Exactly.
Nina, hang on a minute. We're going to talk more with Nina Burley about her book, Unholy Business, The True Tale of Faith, Greed, and Forgery in the Holy Land. What role do religious artifacts play in your life and your faith? Call us, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington, in for Neil Conan. We're talking with Nina Burley about a fascinating case of forgery and religious relics. She tells the story in her new book, Unholy Business, A True Tale of Faith, Greed, and Forgery in the Holy Land. You can read about how one of the richest men in the world became an ancient artifact collector in an excerpt from Unholy Business. It's at our website, npr.org/talk. We do want to hear from you as well. If you have any questions for Nina Burley about this story, this case, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. So, Nina, I want to go back to a little more of the sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark aspect of this story, because you just tell the story. It's a little bit complicated, all the players, but you really, even though we know what happens at the end, you create this sort of great mystery. There is the alleged forgerer, we'll call him, is an Israeli antiquities dealer named Oded Golan. He says he is innocent. How did you come to meet him?
Well, that first trip over, I had 4 days to see whether I could do the story or not. I just parachuted in, basically, and started making phone calls. And his lawyer gave me his number and said, call him. And I knew that he was talking to journalists because I had read interviews with him. And he invited me to his house right away. Went in and... It's in a modest apartment in Tel Aviv. You open the door, and it's like stepping into a museum. The walls are lined with vitrines that keep, a curator's work for many, many years. And on his porch, he had a bunch of ossuaries, these limestone boxes, like the one that became famous. And he put out 2 glasses of water. He's very, very charming gentleman, very, very, very learned in all of these men are in terms. They love ancient history, and he genuinely loves ancient history. Whatever else he's accused of, that is true. He absolutely has a passion for it. And we sat down, and he has this kind of impish face, like reminded me of Joel Grey in the movie Cabaret, with these kind of funny ears and short. And we sat down and chatted, and he didn't, he gave me what I thought, I mean, he didn't, none of the dealers or collectors would ever come clean with me about where they got their stuff. And I had gotten used to that already because I'd been stopping into these shops in the old city before I met him and talking with dealers. But he wouldn't tell me where he got things. He was very, very, I guess, digressive would be the nice way of putting it. Shaggy dog tails would be another way. And I could barely get out the door. I mean, we talked for hours, and I had a driver waiting for me downstairs because at that point I didn't know my way around. I was much late leaving. And, you know, he told me about where he got his things, and he had his own explanation for why, you know, the ossuary sat in his house for so long without him knowing it was important. And he said it was because he's Jewish, and he didn't know that Christ had a brother. And he only understood the importance of it when he invited this scholar who's an expert in ancient languages, to a French scholar, to come to his apartment and look at a different ossuary with a script that he couldn't read on it. And next to that, he gave him pictures, and next to that photograph of the one he couldn't read, he had placed the picture of the one that said James, brother of Jesus. And the scholar is a French seminarian, fallen away priest, and he glanced at that other picture, and he said, "That one, what's that? I want to see that." And, you know, he had written extensively on James, so it's reasonable that Mr. Golan would have been familiar, because he knows who all these scholars are and he knows what their specialties are. It was reasonable for him to know that André Lemaire, the Parisian fallen away priest, knew about James. But anyway, his explanation is he just accidentally had that picture next to the other one. And so then you know, that was the beginning of its stardom. The scholar brought it forth in a magazine that's published in the United States by a Washington-based lawyer, actually.
And then I need to ask about, well, that's the way it became famous. And the way it became infamous is because two officers were taking a smoking break on the roof.
Yes, okay.
Can you tell that story? It's just such a fantastic story.
So fast forward, now, you know, the ossuary's back in Israel. It's become famous, and it's back in Israel, and the scholar cops are trying to locate it and another object, which I guess we're going to get into at some point, that really got them interested. But they were staking out Oded Golan's apartment, watching him come and go, and he was playing this cat and mouse game with them where he wouldn't show them where he had his things. And one of them, it was hot. It's very hot there in the summer. And the cops had decided to go up to the roof of his building instead of hanging about in the lobby, which was all close and cold, dark and hot. So they walked up the steps. They open up to the roof, and they're up on this, whatever it is, the 10th floor of this building. And they're catching the breeze and having a smoke. And all of a sudden, they look over, and they see this kind of little hut on top of the roof. Like, it was like a laundry room. And they kind of poke over, and one of them says, "Oh my goodness, look at this." And there was, on the toilet, the ossuary that is of such great importance to Christians, that people had stood before it tens of thousands in silent prayer in frozen Ontario winter 4 years or 3 years before. And so that's how they located it finally, to then finally test it for its authenticity.
And we discovered that there were definite lapses in his authenticity, shall we say.
Yes. And there were other things that they found there, half-made objects, plans for other objects. I mean, they thought that they came upon a workshop in his apartment.
Well, we do have a couple of callers who do have a few questions or comments. Let's talk to Aaron. Aaron is from Sacramento. And Aaron, you have a question for Nina Burley.
Yeah, I'm just curious, because as I'm listening to the conversation, it seems as though faith obviously plays a huge part in these relics. But I'm wondering, in terms of forgery and whatnot, if the author has had a chance to explore whether or not these objects are used to validate the faith, regardless of whether or not they're forgeries of others, or if it's strictly a monetary, position for them, if they're just trying to make money, or if there really is the idea that they are trying to validate faith.
What did you find, Nina?
Well, if you're asking me about the motives of the forgers, I think it is money. And secondly, I mean, let's again remind you that Oded Golan maintains his innocence, mm-hmm. and he has not been convicted. He's a secular man. He is not religious. So certainly for him, these objects are not about religion. They're about history. Now, the use of forged objects to make money is, I think, part of the deal. But I think also that in his case, or in the forger's case, there's also a desire to be kind of part of ancient history, to stamp yourself, to be with the ancient priest, almost. I think that's kind of what's going on. And the other major objects in this case, they related the two other ones that kind of got the cops interested. One of them is a tablet that has to do with Solomon's Temple. Again, the first archaeological proof that Solomon's Temple existed was found came out of the private market around the same time that the ossuary was brought forth. And if you know anything about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and the temple, the first temple, Solomon's Temple, supposedly existed on the spot where the Temple Mount is today. What the Israelis call the Temple Mount, the Muslims call it something else, and they have had a mosque on top of it since 700 A.D. And then the side of that mount is where the Wailing Wall is, the Western Wall, where you see the Orthodox Jews praying. So this spot is one of the most contentious spots in Israel,
and
in,
if you can
in the
prove
world.
It, and if you can prove that your people were there,
exactly.
And I have this thing that proves it,
exactly. So if there is a motive here, in that case, it had to do with kind of a land rights issue. And the other object that came, it's not part of the trial, but the Israel Museum had paid $500,000 in the 80s for a tiny little ivory pomegranate that was said to have been on the scepter of one of the priests in the First Temple. And it, too, was validated by the same French scholar who validated the ossuary. And it, too, related to, being the first, it's the first archaeological evidence of the First Temple. So after this trial started, or after these objects were actually inspected and deemed forgeries, the Israel Museum, on its own motion, took that object and examined it again and decided it was a forgery. So these three major objects, the ossuary, the tablet, and this little pomegranate, which is 20 years older than the others and is not part of the trial, are related in this way. Were the motives of the forgers religious? I don't think so. But I think, finances, and I think politics.
Nina, we're going to take another call. We're going to talk to Evan from Cincinnati. Hello, Evan.
Hi there. I just wanted to share my experience. I've been on many archaeological digs in Israel, and recently, this past January, I was there for a high school trip for 2.5 months, and I was amazed that a lot of the caves that you'll find from the Bar Kokhba revolt from the Roman era around the year 30 Common Era, and you see that a lot of these have not been explored, either from a lack of money or a lack of interest, because many of the important things around them have already been discovered and nobody really believes that there's anything of dire importance left in these caves. But it was amazing, we would find these little pieces of pottery from the Roman era, and we would also find trash that the British had left over from the Mandate period in the early 1900s. It was very interesting.
Thanks for sharing your experience, Evan. Can you just show up and decide you want to go on a dig?
Almost.
Or just start digging?
well, no, you can't just start digging. That's illegal.
That.
And that's what these plunderers are doing at night. And but you can raise your hand. And, as Evan, sounds like he may have been in high school or college, those are the people doing the digging. You can be in the United States. You can go online. And there are all sorts of sites, diginisrael.com. And you can raise your hand. And if you have a couple $1,000s, you can go over there. And you're working under the instruction, obviously, of an archaeologist. You're working under the, you know, the auspices of an official dig. But yeah, lots of people do that. And, you know, as he pointed out, even the places that aren't being inspected or looked at right now are filled with stuff because it's a really rich place, the historically rich ground. And people, you know, archaeology for Israelis is like, I don't know, like fishing or something for Americans. It's like, you know, their national pastime.
We're speaking with Nina Burley, whose book is called Unholy Business. We'll continue in just a moment. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart, speaking with Nina Burley. Her book is Unholy Business. We've been talking quite a bit about artifacts that have made it into the marketplace. And you talked about something a little bit earlier that I want to get back to, that there were several artifacts which have been deemed to be fakes by certain archaeologists. And some of them were in museums already. So next time I go to the museum and I'm walking around, I'm wondering, am I supposed to believe that everything there has been authenticated?
Well, you know, this book really opened my eyes, the research really opened my eyes to the kind of subjective underbelly of archaeology and biblical archaeology in particular, because as I said, you know, people come to these things with their belief systems and they look at them through a lens. Now, I didn't get in deeply into how much of this stuff might be in museums. The police think that there is some of it in museums, at least sold to them. It may not be on display. And let me just say something about how they don't actually, museums don't actually pay for it. A wealthy collector will pay and then donate it and get a tax write-off. So there's a whole business here of donating these things. And it's not just in biblical archaeology. It's true of all museums. And other writers have actually written more extensively on this issue of forgeries. There's a book I referred to when I was researching it about the Met. And it's rather shocking. The objects on trial involved in this particular trial were only the ones that these police, underfunded guys working 2 years on this case heroically, were able to get their hands on. They couldn't go around the world collecting. They tried to get some people, they thought one of the major objects was in California. A dealer or a collector had collected it and paid big money for it, but they could never get anyone to admit it. You see, people are embarrassed when they've paid that much money for fakes, too.
I can imagine. Before we wrap this conversation, I do want to go to Jerry in Atlantic City, because Jerry's got a little bit of a personal relationship with what we've been talking about. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
I was just listening to my radio, and I heard the name of Oded Golan mentioned. And about 10 years ago, I worked with him in Tel Aviv. And I wrote letters. I mean, I edited the letters that he wrote to some of these experts to verify antiquities, like ancient seals and things like that, as well as working on other projects.
Is he a sincere person?
I'm sorry?
Is he sincere in his desire for collecting antiquities?
Oh, yes. I mean, he was totally into it and totally serious about it. And I don't know, but this is a guy that, he's a very strange guy. And he was so into this world that I don't know whether he just concocted this whole world and thought he was doing something that was, I don't know, momentous and far-reaching. I don't really know. But I do recall working with him, and I don't think, and what I worked on, there was no finagling, there was nothing illegal founding.
Well, he has a lot of real stuff in his house. He has a ton of it.
He does, but I think he just went a little too far, really.
Jerry, thanks for sharing your story.
Yep.
And before we let you go, Nina, we should say that this trial is still going on, correct? This
Indeed
investigation.
It is.
Yeah.
It's their system of swift and speedy justice, or their definition of swift and speedy justice, is a bit different than ours. The judge has been sitting there listening to archaeologists get up on the stand and argue about whether this stuff is real or fake for 3 years. And he finally, a couple weeks ago, actually said to the prosecution, you don't have me convinced here, and I want you to take some time off because it was, you know, these archaeologists are used to talking to sleepy students, not well-paid lawyers who tear them down. And so they haven't been able to make their case. And there is one human witness to the workshop aspect, but he's an Egyptian, and he has no intention of coming to Israel to testify. And, of course, those two countries don't have that kind of reciprocity when it comes to criminal trials. So he won't be testifying.
This is to be continued. Unholy Business, A True Tale of Faith, Greed, and Forgery in the Holy Land, written by Nina Burley. Nina, thanks for spending some time with us.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Up next, New Yorker editor David Remnick on the Obama campaign and a new template for racial identity and running for office. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, thousands of words, hours of videotape, millions of page views have been spent touting something that is historic, but, well, it's a little bit obvious. Barack Obama will be the first African-American president of the United States. What is less obvious is the role race and racial identity played as a quiet theme of his campaign. At least so says the New Yorker editor David Remnick in his essay in the current issue of the magazine. We'll speak with David Remnick in just a moment, but we also do want to hear from you. Is Obama's race meaningful to you? Is it a simple symbol for something larger? Think about it. Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. You can also send us an email at talk@npr.org. David Remnick joins us now from our bureau in New York City. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing just great. So, loved your piece. Read it a couple times through.
There's
one quote that's very interesting. You wrote, "Obama made his racial ancestry a metaphor for his ambition to create a broad coalition of support to rally Americans behind a narrative of moral and political progress." So how did he turn who he is into a winning strategy?
Well, I think unusual for presidential candidates, Barack Obama, despite having many accomplishments in his life, had to rely more on who he is than what he had done as a politician. After all, no matter how you feel about him, and you know, our magazine endorsed him in the end, this is somebody who was in the Illinois State Senate and who was in the U.S. Senate for a little more than a year before deciding to run for president. And so it really, to my mind, can't be denied that his, what you we say who he is, and what we mean here is largely about identity and race the fact that he's biracial, was a very, very important element of his candidacy. It's something sometimes he did talk about, sometimes he didn't want to talk about, and sometimes it's something that he mastered absolutely to make people feel that the United States has gone a long way, and it was a very important element in his creation of a voting coalition. But that's really the start of the discussion.
Well, let's talk about a sort of an overt way when his race became part of the conversation during his campaign, and maybe a more subtle example.
Well, it was there from the very start. Remember, he announces his candidacy on the steps of the old state capitol building in Springfield, Illinois, where Lincoln had announced his candidacy for Senate. And this already has implications. It's not just about the state of Illinois, after all. It's drawing, you know, we must say that Barack Obama has enormous ambition and audacity, is one of his favorite words. He very often makes speeches where he is proposing the advancement of the country, and implicit in what he's saying is that the advancement will be best represented and embodied by his election as president. And after all, somebody who is African-American doesn't have to talk about it all the time. He's self-evidently African-American. What changed the game? After all, African-Americans have been running for president for a very long time, either symbolically or in a very real way, as with Jesse Jackson in the 80s. He had to run for president if he was going to win in an entirely new way. He had to push race to the background for most days of the year of his campaign. And when he did have to talk about race in the most central moment of his campaign, he was forced to do it. It came from the Jeremiah Wright incident, when the videotapes of Jeremiah Wright saying "God damn America" and "the chickens have come home to roost" started circulating on network television and cable television. Then he had to make a speech about race. He had told his people and his campaign for months and months that he had wanted to make a speech on race, and they all talked him out of it. They said it was irrelevant. It was beside the point. First, he had to convince white voters that he was serious. So it's a very, very complex subject, but it is inextricably bound up with his appeal to many people, and I think it's also bound up with some people's disinclination to vote for him, certainly.
It's interesting that you talked about his people, the people he surrounded himself with, and their suggestion, you know, let's not talk about race at this. David Axelrod, his chief campaign strategist, but he also planned...
Yeah, but David Axelrod was somebody who had been instrumental in electing four black mayors in the United States.
You got me to my point, yes.
Right, and had been behind Deval Patrick becoming the governor of Massachusetts, the first black governor of Massachusetts. So this was somebody very experienced in the tactics and language and thinking about electoral politics where race is concerned.
So I'm wondering what it would have been like if David Axelrod had been helping strategize for, say, a Joe Biden.
I think David Axelrod is an excellent, as he proved, extremely disciplined, organized, in a very smart way, phlegmatic campaign head. I think he could certainly be important in a race with where a white person is running for any candidacy. I don't think that I think that goes without saying.
The title of the piece is "The Joshua Generation," and I'm assuming, and I should ask, that you're making a reference to Joshua and Moses, and Joshua taking over as a leader.
Exactly, but the language is Obama's himself. Not long after he announced for the presidency, he went to Selma, Alabama, and there was a commemoration there of the civil rights marches in Alabama of the 60s. And at a church service, Obama gave the main address. And in the audience were many people who you would call in the Moses generation, or what Obama called in the Moses generation. John Lewis would be a perfect example, mm-hmm. somebody who was beaten nearly to death during those marches. And he paid tribute to them, and he paid tribute to their protests and to their suffering, and sometimes to their martyrdom in some instances, of course, like Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and the rest. And then he said, "I stand on the shoulder of giants," meaning the people who were in this Moses generation. "And I am a member, however, of the Joshua generation." The Moses generation did not reach the promised land. What is the promised land? Of equality, of electing someone president. And in that speech, in describing the Joshua generation, he said, "Look, we've made great advances. We've moved many thousands, many millions into the middle class. Certain kinds of discrimination are not practiced as they used to be, or not as overtly, certainly not in the same scale. We've come a long way, but we've forgotten a lot of history. We talk a lot about making money, the Oprah money, as he called it, mm-hmm. to great laughs. But what are we going to do? How are we going to reach the promised land? It's not all about us as individuals and making money and individual advancement. What are we going to do in terms of public service, and what are we going to do for humanity and for the race?" And he proposed himself essentially as the leader of a Joshua generation, and to head that generation and be president.
I want to bring in Tim from Irish Hills, Michigan. He echoes something that's in your article. Tim?
Yes, I'm here.
Why don't you explain to me and to David what you think about Obama's ancestry that is a positive, that could bring positive change?
Well, he straddles more than one culture. I mean, he comes from a place, you know, Hawaii, which is kind of unusual for American politics. He's been around in different places in the world. He's obviously part, you know, Nigerian, he's part white. His mother was white. And I think he kind of, you know, emblemizes the fact that people are multidimensional. And I think that's really important now, because we've tended to see things as one-dimensional and been really polarized, and he kind of brings things together that way. Plus, he's extremely intelligent, and he does it in a way that he does things in a way that's non-polarizing.
Well, Tim, you make an excellent point. I just should say, by the way,
he's Kenyan, right?
Kenyan,
yeah.
Not Nigerian. But
Kenyan, I'm
but
sorry.
Everything you say is true, and I think it's part of his appeal, and it adds to his ability to pose himself as an embracing as a figure. Both real and metaphorical, who embraces the diversity of the American people. And it also means that he is able to sit in a room and understand intimately what people are saying to him. Al Sharpton said, you know, he said this to me in the piece, he said, Obama can understand a white Kansan every bit as intimately and with the same nuance immediately as he can someone from Harvard, from the Harlem political structure. And that's a unique talent. I should also say, though, that, you know, race is a very complex thing. And the majority, I don't know what the numbers are, but a huge number of people that we consider African-American in this country have at one point or another had whether Caucasian blood or Asian, in their genetic background. And these distinctions, of course, go back to the old slave distinction of one drop of black blood equals a black man. I mean, these distinctions have their root in terrible racism, which for the most part have receded.
We've got an email from someone who, Larry in Houston, who doesn't really care for the fact that we're talking about race in terms of why Obama perhaps has appealed to so many. He says, he won in spite of his race, his name and the rumors. Ask your guests about the ideas he has talked about. That doesn't that count for something? Change from the ground up.
Of course, it counts for everything. There's no doubt also that Obama would not have emerged as a major candidate had he not been an anti-Iraq war candidate. One of the reasons he had a leg up early on against Hillary Clinton was that he was the most distinctly anti-war voice on the debating platform, at least among the major candidates. I'm not, of course, his ideas are important. There are many ways to look at this campaign. I'm only suggesting, and please, I want to be very clear about it, that race is only one element of it. In fact, that's very much the point. In earlier presidential campaigns, when there was a black man or woman on the ticket, race was very, very much in the forefront. It was very much in the forefront of what they had to say in their stump speeches. In fact, in Obama's stump speech, very, very rarely was race mentioned. But I would argue, and I think everybody in the Obama campaign realizes and says so, that race had a certain kind of appeal for many voters.
And we're going to talk to one of those voters in just a moment. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker. And I do want to go to Tom from Jacksonville, Florida. Now, Tom, you voted for whom?
I voted for Barack Obama.
And, Tom, you're not a Democrat, are you?
I'm a Republican. But I've been around the world many times. I'm a military man, and one of the things that I saw in him was hope. And every time he opens his mouth, I feel inspired. And I think that that's what we need as an American people. And I think the biggest problem that we have is that everybody picks a side, and instead of coming together after we all make a choice. Only, and it's really the outer fringes of hardcore people. But if you look at the African American community throughout our history, African Americans have contributed in so many ways that we, if we were just a white society, we would never have a lot of the comforts, and we would not have a lot of the accomplishments that we have as an American people.
Tom, thanks a lot. David, as we go forward, as we start to think about President Obama, he's president-elect right now, do you think these themes that you wrote about during the campaign will translate into his administration in any way?
Well, I think in some ways, but I think they may recede. In terms of the problems that he's got to face most immediately, a half-wrecked economic system, a recession, an entire auto industry on the brink of bankruptcy, two wars abroad, and the litany. Mm. I'm not sure that race is absolutely on the forefront of what he's got to deal with in the first 100 days of his presidency. On the other hand, I think there'll be a lot of disappointed people around, and not only African Americans. They'll be quite disappointed if at some point that he doesn't address race and some of the problems that have traditionally gone along with it sooner or later. I think that, for example, if racial profiling is never addressed by a black president, it seems to me that would be an omission that would be quite glaring, and certainly not. That's just one example of many.
David Remnick is editor of The New Yorker magazine. He joined us from our New York bureau. You can read his essay at our website, npr.org/blogofthenation. Very nice to speak with you, David.
Great talking to you.
And before we sign off today, a sad update on a story that we talked about last week. Motel Brody, the 12-year-old boy in the middle of a court fight over the legal definition of life, has died. Doctors declared the boy legally brain dead on November 4th, but his parents sued the hospital. He was on life support, and based on their religious views, their son was still alive. After a fight with brain cancer, Motel Brody's heart stopped beating early Saturday morning. He was buried near his home in Brooklyn. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart.